Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
A win for workers at the New Yorker magazine. Nurses frustrated and ready to strike. And today on the show, fighting wage theft, the latest from the progressive populace, and the U.S. Supreme Court picks. Deja vu all over again. Good afternoon and welcome to the Friday, October 9th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, as well as Spotify. Don't forget, we're on Facebook, AWF Union Podcast, which is also our Twitter handle, AWF Union Podcast. We have three guests on the show today. You may recall about a week ago, we had Dorsey Hager, one of our regulars on the show, talking about an ordinance passed in Columbus, Ohio, dealing with wage theft. Well, joining us in about 12-13 minutes is John Wentz. Now, he's a partner with the law firm based in Columbus, Barkan Mizlich, and he is chair of the firm's labor law practice. He has extensive experience representing private as well as public sector labor organizations, and he's worked with some of the big ones and some of the best. International Brotherhood of Teamsters, the Communication Workers of America, Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen, American Federation of Teachers, the International Association of Firefighters. He has served as lead negotiator in contract talks for unions representing airline, production, assembly, warehouse, driver, sales, healthcare, professional, and government employees. He also serves as a member of the board of directors from the Central Ohio Worker Center and co-chair of the organization's Worker Justice Committee. This is a nonprofit group advocating on behalf of low-income and immigrant workers, and this is the group that played a lead role in helping to pass a wage theft prevention ordinance in Columbus, Ohio, and that's what we're going to talk about, how this happened, and this was a consortium of labor organizations pretty much led by the building trades to get it done. And the good news about this, and I say this on the show many, many times, and you've heard it, how unions bring up everyone. They level the playing field, and they lift all boats. If you take a look at the statistics on wage theft, you will find that a lot of the victims do not belong to unions. They're low-wage workers. They're working in retail and restaurants, and they get screwed by their bosses all the time. Thousands of dollars a year in many cases. And they're making, sometimes they're lucky to make $15,000, $20,000 a year. And then maybe $1,000, $2,000, $3,000 is missing from their paychecks. That's a large percentage of their income. So John is going to talk about all of that as our first guest. Jimmy Cullen, who is one of our regulars on behalf of the Progressive Populace. This is the October 15th edition of the Populace. He's going to touch on the debate, the first debate between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. But this is primarily going to be about the replacement of the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and how quickly the Republicans want to fill that seat. I mean, lightning speed. There's so many people hurting right now, need assistance, hopefully a stimulus. But Mitch McConnell is of the opinion, who cares? Who cares? We got to keep this conservative majority. And keep in mind, if Barrett gets on, we're talking about a 6-3 conservative majority on the Supreme Court. So this is a really good piece, and he gets into some detail. And lastly, Joyce Goldstein, who is another one of our regulars, will be joining us to give us her opinion. First of all, she was devastated by Ginsburg's death. And again, you have a woman that's going to replace her, but wait a minute, complete opposites when it comes to political ideology. And she is going to talk about Barrett's role in some of her decisions. One of her decisions dealt with Grubhub and Epic Systems. Joyce is going to explain that. But when it comes to Ginsburg, it's not that she wrote majority opinions, which she did not. It was her dissenting opinions that spoke volumes. And Joyce will reference that. And she's going to reflect back. You may recall in, 1991, Thurgood Marshall left the court. And he was replaced by who? Clarence Thomas. Same kind of scenario. Political opposites. Marshall on one side, Thomas on the other. So it's interesting to see how some things never change in America. So Joyce is going to be our third guest right here on America's Workforce. Well, we've got some good news to report out of New York. Workers at the New Yorker magazine have won their fight for a just cause provision. Check this out. For the first time in the magazine's 95-year history, its workers will not be at-will employees and will have a guarantee that they will only be disciplined or fired for cause. Now, while negotiations for a final contract are ongoing, both management and the union have confirmed that a just cause provision will be included in the contract. That's huge. That's huge. The agreement came as the union staged a digital picket around the New Yorker Festival. The picket was called off after the agreement. Now, pressure on the management grew when two key people joined in. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Elizabeth Warren pulled out of the festival, this was about 2 weeks ago, saying they would not cross a picket line. Now, the union's president, Susan DeCarava, said that the expression of solidarity from the politicians was crucial. And this is a quote. I do want to give some credit to management at the New Yorker for finally being able to listen and hear what their employees were saying and how important it was. I think the involvement of Cortez and Warren helped them hear us a little bit better. Just another example of how people in power can make a big difference. Meanwhile, I want to talk a little bit about nurses. More than 6 months into the pandemic, nurses are beginning to assert their labor power more and more frequently. This according to an article in the American Prospect, good publication. Prospect.com is their website. And they report thousands of nurses and hospital workers around the country are either taking part in or have authorized strikes. The strikes and strike authorization votes have generally tended to focus around bread and butter workplace issues. For example, about 1,000 nurses in California represented by the service employees. This is Local 1021. They authorized a strike after 9 months of negotiations went nowhere, and management insisted on wage freezes and cuts to benefits in the middle of a pandemic. Cut your benefits. Now, the pressures of the pandemic are having an impact on the fights in Albany, New York. Over 2,000 nurses, they're part of the New York Nurses Association. They authorized a strike after management at the Albany Medical Center froze wages and cut hours during the pandemic. Jennifer Bejo is one of the nurses there, and she said, and this is a quote, nurses are getting burned out working through meal times and breaks. We are constantly putting our nurses and patients at risk in these working conditions with less support. Now, more than ever, we need a contract and a good one. All right, we have another one here. More than 150 members of AFSCME District Council 37. They represent tens of thousands of New York City government workers. They've died from COVID-19. Now, the union is fighting back against proposed layoffs and cuts to vital public services in the city that was once the epicenter of the pandemic in the country. You may recall that back in the spring. This is another quote here. Our frontline workers stood up, and since the first cases were reported, they did everything that was asked them and more. As the pandemic raged on, tens of thousands of municipal workers bravely served the public, risking their lives every day to provide and maintain needed services despite long odds against them. That comment from Henry Garrido, executive director of District Council 37. He went on to say these workers will always be heroes. They are essential in the very meaning of the word. And as such, they shall stay on the job. AFSCME is in the vanguard of fighting for the Heroes Act to provide emergency funding to state and municipal governments to keep these frontline workers employed throughout the country. Well, it's interesting. There's a lot of labor organizations that are still trying to get the Heroes Act passed. Again, this is legislation passed in the House May 15th, calling for over $3 trillion to help people like the ones I just talked about in New York and in California. Legislation that's badly needed. It's on again. It's off again. Trump says one thing, changes his mind the next. Who knows where it's going to go? But the point is this. We need it, and we need it right away. Sad that I have to even talk about situations like this, but that's the reality of it. All right, I have to take a break. You're listening to America's Workforce, our segment with John Wentz talking about the Columbus Wage Theft Ordinance. Coming up next. Don't go away. We'll be back right after this.
This is America's Workforce.
LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, is the most progressive, aggressive, and fastest-growing union of construction workers, and one of the most diverse and effective unions representing public service employees. LIUNA members are on the forefront of the construction industry, a sector that is a powerhouse of 12 million workers producing 5% of our country's economic output, a half million strong. We're united through collective bargaining agreements which help us earn family-supporting pay, good benefits, and the opportunity for advancement and better lives. With Mobile Action LIUNA, you can get updates on your cell phone, find out how to sign petitions, and download union ringtones. Be a part of your union's political and organizing efforts by sending a text message on your cell phone with the word LIUNA to the number 69866. Through the LIUNA Action Network, you can stay informed about your union with a one-minute update and action alerts.
Nurses, doctors, and caregivers at the VA are under attack. They face hostile management, callous agency heads, and an administration that's stomping all over their ability to speak up for our veterans. Unions are even being kicked out of their offices, a direct attempt to silence the voice of VA employees. When VA workers are under attack, veterans pay the price. Costly privatization and outsourcing will run rampant, meaning fewer services and worse quality of care for our nation's heroes. It's time to stand up for the workers who care for our veterans. Paid for by the American Federation of Government Employees.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And welcome back to America's Workforce, where we are available on various platforms, and that includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, as well as Spotify. Let's go to a line number two, and joining us is John Wentz, who is a partner with the law firm based in Columbus, Ohio, of Barkin Meislish, and they specialize in labor law. In fact, he's been doing it for over two decades. You may recall a week ago on this show, we had Dorsey Hager of the Columbus Central Ohio Building Trades talking about an ordinance in Columbus about wage theft. And this is a very, very important issue to address on the show because millions of Americans are literally ripped off each and every day by their employers. So, John, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us here on America's Workforce.
Thanks for having me, Flash. I appreciate it.
Now, talk to me first about this this ordinance in Columbus. Did you help draft it? What was your role, and where are we with it?
Well, the ordinance has been passed by Columbus City Council. The effort was led by Council Member Rob Dorans. In addition to being a member of Columbus City Council, Rob is also a union attorney, a building trades attorney in Columbus. I think it's safe to say that we wouldn't have an ordinance in the city of Columbus protecting workers against wage theft without Rob's leadership and without the coalition of organizations and community members that Rob put together to move this legislation forward. As I said, there was a coalition of organizations. In addition to practicing union side labor law, I am also a member of the board of directors of the Central Ohio Workers Center, which is an organization that advocates for low-income and immigrant workers. The Workers Center played a lead role in the Wage Theft Coalition, along with the AFL-CIO, the Central Ohio Labor Council, and the Columbus Building Trades. You mentioned your previous guest, Dorsey Hager. Dorsey played a very important role from the beginning of this process, which started almost 2 years ago when we started to build a coalition to secure the kind of protections that we needed. Mark Fluharty, the executive director of the Central Labor Council, also played a key and important role in the process. Labor made passing a wage theft ordinance in Columbus priority number one. It did so even though most union members don't face wage theft. Wage theft is a problem that primarily affects non-union workers. But consistent with what the labor movement does, this coalition of community organizations and unions made protecting the most vulnerable workers in our community a high priority. And I'm happy to say we now have a very strong wage theft ordinance in Columbus.
Well, we always say, John, that unions lift all boats, and this is a good example of that. Talk to me about the penalties here. If an employer is ripping off his or her employees, what can happen to them?
So under the ordinance, if an employer receives an adverse determination, in other words, they are found guilty by a court or by an administrative agency of committing wage theft, then as a result of that adverse determination, the employer will be prohibited from 3 years for receiving any city contracts, as well as prohibited from receiving any city tax incentives. The way the language in the ordinance works is that the prohibition would apply to contractors on city contracts, subcontractors of those contractors, and subs of subs. The same goes for working on development sites that are covered by a wide range of tax incentives. So if you are an employer, if you are a contractor, if you are a subcontractor, and you commit wage theft, then the ordinance contains a three-year prohibition on contracts and working on those tax-incentivized development sites. In addition, the ordinance sets up a wage theft enforcement commission whose duties include investigating violations of the ordinance. And if a violation of the ordinance is discovered, then the commission can also make recommendations to city council for additional remedies or penalties in the case of actual violations. And those additional penalties include, for example, clawing back a tax incentive, loss of low interest rate commercial loan benefits, suspension or revocation of city grants that have been given to an employer who has committed wage theft violations. So this is an ordinance that has some real teeth in it, and that's important because it's the lack of enforcement at the federal and state level is what caused the city of Columbus and other cities around the country to take this kind of action to not only protect working people, but also to protect law-abiding businesses who are put at a competitive disadvantage when some employers cheat by stealing money from their workers.
Yeah. Well, like I said, this is a national issue here, and we've got some numbers to report. In the state of Ohio, minimum wage violations alone cost Ohio workers $600 million a year. And check this, more than 900,000 Ohio workers are misclassified, costing Ohio more than $790 million in tax revenue, workers' comp, and unemployment premiums. John, I have to ask you, that being said, why don't we see more people tackling this issue? It seems like it's done in the example, Columbus, Ohio, city by city. The fact that they're losing this amount of tax revenue, why aren't lawmakers more vigilant on the state and on the federal level? What's your answer to that?
Well, I think you're asking the right question. In Ohio, for example, there was a study done on the enforcement and monitoring practices in our state back in 2019. There are 6 wage and hour agents to monitor a labor force of 5.5 million workers in the state of Ohio. So, I mean, you really have to think about that. 6 agents that monitor a workforce of 5.5 million. It's obviously not a priority at the federal and state level. It should be. And I think it's up to organized labor. It's up to worker centers. It's up to community members to shed light on what is really one of the most serious crimes that working people face. I mean, this has been called a quiet crisis. It's been called a quiet crime. And I think it's long past the time where we raise our voices and point out that this needs to be addressed for what it is. And it is a crime to steal wages from working people. Everyone who works deserves to get paid for the work that they performed. And until the federal government and until the states step up and start enforcing wage and hour laws, we're going to have to do it at the local level. I'm glad the city of Columbus took a leadership role. Other cities around the nation are doing the same. And I think given the magnitude of this problem, we can't wait for the federal government or state government to act. We need to do it locally. So that's what we did in Columbus.
Well, my hat's off to you and all the people that made this possible in Columbus, Ohio. Good stuff. One step at a time. Yeah, you got people that are getting screwed on the low end. You said low income workers, and then you got the state losing money on tax revenue. You would think, come on, let's get this thing solved. It's ridiculous. Well, John, thank you so much for joining us. Great work on that. And we'll have any other cities asked for your input, maybe in the state of Ohio to pass a similar ordinance at this stage?
Well, not yet. I know we're certainly standing by and happy to help. Cincinnati has a wage theft ordinance, and the coalition in Columbus has spent a lot of time talking to our colleagues there. They were good partners and good advisors, and certainly the folks in Columbus who worked on this ordinance are ready to work with with anybody. This is this is a problem that affects all working people. It is a crime that affects low income workers. It's a crime that disproportionately affects black workers and brown workers and women. But it affects all workers, regardless of who they are. And I think it's something we've got to prioritize, as you said, at the local level. And we're ready to do that and ready to help.
I like that. All right, John, thank you so much for your input. John Wentz, partner at the Columbus, Ohio law firm of Barkin Meislish, barkinmeislish.com. The other website I want to drive people to is Central CentralOhioWorkerCenter.org, CentralOhioWorkerCenter.org. A lot of information there. John, thank you so much, and please keep in touch with us, all right?
Thank you very much for having me, Flash.
That was fun. John Wentz, again, is his name, partner with the law firm Barkan Meislich, dealing with wage theft in the state of Ohio, which is a problem all around the country. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, our segment with Jimmy Cullen on behalf of the progressive populace. Also later in the show, Joyce Goldstein will be joining us talking about the Supreme Court. It's all part of America's Workforce. Back in a few minutes.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
America's Workforce Radio is sponsored in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 6, representing painters, glazers, drywall finishers, and sign and display industry workers. They remind you that belonging to a union is your right as an American.
The AFL-CIO is a proud sponsor of America's Workforce Radio. United by efforts to raise wages, listeners to this show and workers all across America are beginning to turn a corner and drive the economic debate. The AFL-CIO is comprised of 12.5 million working people from 56 unions, but we stand with and fight for everyone who is working for a better life. For more information about our raising wages agenda, go to AFLCIO.org.
You're listening to America's Workforce, and this next segment brought to you by the North Coast Labor Federation.
Chris LaGrange here, host of UCOM Live with Chris LaGrange. News, talk, sports, and workforce politics. The fastest growing podcast on, in, and around the internet. Join us live every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Twitter with archives on UCOMLive.com. Our loud and colorful panelists bring you current events like no other. So follow and subscribe today wherever great podcasts are found.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And welcome back to America's Workforce, where we are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, iHeartRadio, as well as Spotify. Once again, we ask that you subscribe to our podcast network. Give us a rating. A five-star rating would be greatly appreciated. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the fine folks at the United Labor Agency. They're trying desperately to connect as many people with employment as possible. 216-666-2185. You can find them online at ulagency.org. All right, let's go to line number one. Welcome one of our regulars, Jimmy Cullen, editor of the Progressive Populace, twice monthly magazine of politics, economic news, general news for workers, small businesses, you name it. Trial subscription, just $18 for 6 months. That'll get you 11 issues and get a free sample by calling this number at the end of the show, 1-800-205-7067. Website is populace.com. Hey, Jimmy, welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us once again.
Thanks.
All right. I know you want to talk about the Supreme Court here, but first and foremost, I'm sure you saw the first debate with Donald Trump and Joe Biden. I don't want to get into too many details here. I don't know if you watch the whole 90 minutes of it, but what's your impression here? I'd love to hear your take on it.
Well, I did make it through, and I thought Trump probably solidified his hold on his base of about 30% of the voters. But I don't see how he attracted anybody new to his cause, and which is in trouble for somebody who's only got about 40 to 43% in the polls so far. One thing I think he tried to do was to rattle Joe Biden and possibly try to get him into stuttering, which Trump failed to do. And if anything, it enabled Biden to leap over the bar that they set for him. I thought Biden did okay, and Trump basically came out in favor of white supremacy, which is probably a wrong move at this point in time. And some people wonder whether they should bother to have any more debates. I think it's good to let Biden make his appeal to voters around the country, and let Trump show what a backward person he is, and totally incapable of leading and uniting the country.
Yeah. Good observation. We'll see what happens in debate number two and see if they change any of the rules in that one. Maybe, like, shut off a microphone?
I'd have to put them okay. in a soundproof roof.
Yeah. Let's get into your latest editorial here. This is posted for October 15th, and it deals with the Supreme Court. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I just noted that it took less than 90 minutes after the death of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on September 18th for Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to affirm that he planned to push Donald Trump's nominee onto the court as soon as possible. Trump says Republicans need to rush a new justice onto the Supreme Court before the election because he expects the court, with another right-wing vote to reinforce the conservative bloc, will help him steal the election despite his trailing in polls that portend his defeat. And the Republican loss of the Senate, if mailed-in ballots are allowed to be counted, he said, now we're counting on the federal court system to make it so that we can actually have an evening where we know who wins, not where the votes are going to be counted a week later or 2 weeks later, Trump said at a rally in North Carolina on September 19th. Trump and Republicans have accused Democrats of planning election fraud by voting by mail during a pandemic when many jurisdictions have cut polling places. There is little evidence that voting by mail contributes to fraud. In fact, Trump has voted by mail and is expected to do so in this election. But Republicans don't want to make it easier for Democrats to vote in these pandemic days, particularly when Republicans appear headed for a thrashing. So Republicans set about to sabotage the U.S. Postal Service to reduce confidence that mail ballots will make it to election officials in time. And the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg was a blow because it opened the possibility that Trump would get to replace her with a third right-wing justice on the Supreme Court. Republicans have abandoned the pretense that they should leave the filling of the Supreme Court vacancy this close to the election to the next president, as they solemnly claimed in 2016, after Justice Antonin Scalia died in February of 2016, McConnell said President Barack Obama shouldn't even bother to nominate a replacement in election year. After Obama went ahead and nominated Merrick Garland, who was a respected moderate chief judge on the D.C. Courts of Appeals in March 2016, 8 months before the election, Republicans denied a hearing, agreeing with McConnell that it was too close to the election. Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, who was chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee in 2016, defended the rebuff then and reiterated his position this past July. He said, if I were chairman of the committee and this vacancy occurred, I would not have a hearing on it because that's what I promised the people in 2016. But on September 21st, he buckled and said he would support McConnell's decision to move forward to fill the vacancy before the election. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, the current Judiciary Committee chair, also said in 2016 in defending the rejection of Garland, the rule against seating new Supreme Court judges in election years should apply to Republican presidents, too. He said, I want you to use my words against me, Graham said in 2016. If there's a Republican president in 2016 and a vacancy occurs in the last year of the first term, you can say Lindsey Graham said, let's let the next president, whoever it might be, make that nomination, unquote. And Trump went on to explain the new rule on Fox News. He said, when you have the Senate, when you have the votes, you can sort of do what you want as long as you have it, unquote. So it's pretty much the same as the old rule. But if Democratic leader Charles Schumer can keep all 47 of the senators of his caucus in line, he would need four Republican senators to join the Democrats in stopping a Supreme Court promotion this year. But only Senators Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Susan Collins of Maine have come out against filling the seat until after the election. And if Biden wins, they would let him name the new justice. But Democrats should play hardball in the showdown over the replacement of Ruth Bader Ginsburg by Amy Coney Barrett, a right-wing judge who's only been a judge for 2.5 years. And McConnell might be able to marshal the votes to confirm the sixth conservative for the high court and form a block on the court that Republicans hope will impede progressive legislation for a generation and possibly roll back established legislation that's been in place for years. But Democrats must play their own strong hand, redoubling efforts to not only beat Trump, but also regain a Senate majority. And Senator Ed Markey, a Democrat from Massachusetts, called for the Senate Democrats to eliminate the filibuster if Republicans move to expand conservative majority on the Supreme Court by filling the vacancy. Mitch McConnell said the president, Markey said, no Supreme Court vacancies filled in an election year. If he violates it, when Democrats control the Senate in the next Congress, we must abolish the filibuster and expand the Supreme Court. Now, Joe Biden is not promoting that alternative, and in the debate, he refused to say whether he would support expanding the court. It's probably a good idea not to rule it out, because he should focus on the wrongness of another corrupt nomination and say he hopes the president doesn't force a future Democratic Senate to do so. And Schumer said Democrats should keep all possibilities on the table. Some Democrats are wary that threatening to expand the court will make the final month of the election a battle over abortion rights. But you can bet abortion opponents already are planning to vote for Trump. But Democrats should raise the alarm that in a 6-3 conservative court is likely to overturn the Affordable Care Act in its entirety, including the requirement that insurance covers pre-existing conditions. And the conservative bloc might be emboldened to overturn Medicare, Medicaid, and even the 85-year-old Social Security Act, which Trump already is trying to defund through his own executive orders suspending the payroll tax that funds the retirement plans. So if Republicans achieve their dream of overturning Obamacare during the lame duck session, Democrats should get the gumption to expand the court in February with four more liberal justices who will go along if Congress decides to expand Medicare to cover everybody. And a new Democratic Congress could remove the ceiling on payroll tax collections, which now stop after $137,700 in annual earnings. And that will prevent the Social Security Fund from becoming insolvent in 2035 and also allows expansion of benefits. So with a liberal court majority, Congress also can restore the Voting Rights Act and reverse the census rigging that the Trump administration has been attempting to enable another decade of Republican gerrymandering. And Republicans will screech that Democrats are trying to pack the court, but in fact, Congress has changed the size of the Supreme Court 7 times in our history, from the original 6 justices to as many as 10 in 1863. And after the Civil War, Congress in 1866 reduced the number of justices to 7 to prevent President Andrew Johnson from appointing new members to the court. And in 1869, after Johnson left office, Congress raised the number of justices back to 9, which the court has numbered ever since. But during the Great Depression, conservatives on the court struck down several New Deal programs during President Franklin D. Roosevelt's first term. And after his sweeping reelection in 1936, Roosevelt proposed in 1937 that Congress increase the number of justices to as many as 15 members. And FDR relented when one of the justices moderated to allow the laws to take effect, and another conservative judge retired, prompting a humorist to quip, "A switch in time saved 9." So maybe it's time for another switch.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, 15 members on the Supreme Court. That would be interesting. All right, it's all contained in the Progressive Populist. Populist.com is a website, toll-free number 1-800-205-7067. Good stuff, Jimmy. You take care, be safe, and we'll be talking to you down the road.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Again, Jimmy Cullen, editor of the Progressive Populist, Populist.com for more information. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Joyce Goldstein will be joining us to talk more about the Supreme Court and what may lie ahead. It's all part of America's Workforce. Back in a few minutes.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
LIUNIV, the Laborers International Union of North America, is the most progressive, aggressive, and fastest-growing union of construction workers, and one of the most diverse and effective unions representing public service employees. LIUNA members are on the forefront of the construction industry, a sector that is a powerhouse of 12 million workers producing 5% of our country's economic output. A half million strong. We're united through collective bargaining agreements which help us earn family-supporting pay, good benefits, and the opportunity for advancement and better lives. With Mobile Action LIUNA, you can get updates on your cell phone, find out how to sign petitions, and download union ringtones. Be a part of your union's political and organizing efforts by sending a text message on your cell phone with the word LIUNA to the number 69866. Through the LIUNA Action Network, you can stay informed about your union with a one-minute update and action alerts.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy,
and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And we're back. It's called America's Workforce, where we are available on various platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts. You can check us out on Facebook, AWF Union Podcasts, and follow us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle, AWF Union Podcast. Let's go to line number three. Always enjoy talking to this lady. Longtime labor lawyer. In fact, some changes in her law firm starting, I guess, in a couple of weeks, is it? JoyceGoldsteinLaw.com. Your longtime partner, Susan Gregel, is retiring. Is that right, Joyce?
Yes, she is. She's going to be retiring from the active practice. I still think she's going to be doing some work, but a lot less than what she had been doing. So I wish her well.
Okay, good, good. So you'll have quite a lot on your plate here, including America's Workforce. We appreciate your contributions. So let's talk about the U.S. Supreme Court today. As you know, We've got some changes in the works, and they're not satisfying to many appetites out there. Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away a couple of weeks ago, and the possible replacement is Amy Coney Barrett. Quite a contrast. I'd like to get your point of view on what may happen here, and obviously taking a look back at two distinctly different people here. Joyce, it's all yours. Talk to me about this.
Well, first I would just like to say that it's such a loss. It's just such a loss to the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She was, for me, such a personal icon. She was a trailblazing Jewish woman lawyer. She was fearless and creative and passionate and always respectful toward those with whom she disagreed. She was analytical. She just was a remarkable person, and the contribution she made to the jurisprudence of our country, to the advancement of the rights of so many people, particularly of women, is just, what can I say? I mean, I have so much admiration for her and her achievements, and her death on the eve of the Jewish New Year was especially for me, powerful and meaningful. She truly was a righteous person who I think we just all owe a debt of gratitude. So I guess I would like to just begin by saying that about the late Justice Ginsburg.
You told me that she was probably most popular for her dissents. Let's talk about that. I guess her dissents were very well prepared and they spoke volumes. Maybe some cases come to mind here we could talk about?
Yes, they certainly did. I mean, on the court, she was often a dissenter through her time on the court of 27 years. She was frequently in the minority, especially in some of the big controversial cases. And when she knew she was going to be in the minority, it was very, very important to her to write really thoughtful dissents for, and she wrote those dissents to be a roadmap for those coming after her. It was, you know, kind of like a Hansel and Gretel of leaving the breadcrumbs there to be followed after, so that those who in, you know, future generations, future courts could see what it was that she thought, where the law should be headed. And so her dissents were incredibly powerful and very intentional to for that purpose. She wrote them for the future.
Well, one of them, what was it, Epic Systems? She wrote that dissent a couple of years ago. Can you tell us about that one?
Yeah, sure. And I think, as you and I had talked about, it's an interesting case also to draw the contrast between Justice Ginsburg and Judge Barrett, who's now been nominated by President Trump to replace, not that she could, but to technically replace Justice Ginsburg and her position on the court. And so the Epic Systems case as I say, it's an interesting contrast between the two judges, because both the Epic Systems case and the other one that I wanted to mention is this Grubhub case. They both involved employment-related arbitrations. And in both cases, there were groups of workers who were trying to avoid individual employment arbitrations. And in the Grubhub case, Judge Barrett, the nominee, as she's been sitting on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, she, in the Grubhub case, forced workers into arbitration by narrowly construing an exception to the Federal Arbitration Act that otherwise would have said that those workers would have been entitled to pursue a wage and hour collective action. She said, no, they couldn't do that. They had to honor the arbitration agreement that supposedly they had entered into voluntarily. And by contrast, we had the Epic Systems case, which had a similar outcome from the majority on the court. But and this was a 2018 case in which Justice Ginsburg wrote a really terrific dissent. And the dissent, it captured how she understood the realities of the workplace and really drew attention to the fact that employees and employers do not have equal bargaining power. And in that case, the majority opinion was written by Justice Neil Gorsuch, a Trump appointee, and the Supreme Court held that an employer could lawfully require its employees to agree as a condition of employment to take all of their employment-related disputes to private arbitration on an individual basis, and that they waived their right to participate in class action or class arbitration. And what was at the heart of the majority opinion, the one written by Justice Gorsuch, was that he said that he framed the issue as one of freedom to contract between equal parties. In her dissent, what Justice Ginsburg wrote, and this is a quote, she said, "To explain why the court's decision is egregiously wrong, I first refer to the extreme imbalance once prevalent in our nation's workplaces and Congress's aim in federal labor laws to place employers and employees on a more equal footing." And she criticized the majority's analysis by saying the court's opinion opens with the question, should employees and employers be allowed to agree that any disputes between them will be resolved through one-on-one arbitration? And then she went on to say, but were the agreements genuinely bilateral? Because what she noted was that the company emailed its employees an arbitration agreement requiring resolution of wage and hour claims by these individual arbitrations. And the agreement provided that if employees continued to work for the company, they would be deemed to have accepted the agreement. So they didn't actually agree to accept the agreement. It was imposed on them, or they'd lose their jobs, as we've talked about on this show and in other situations. And what Justice Ginsburg said, quote, was forced to face their employers alone. Employees ordinarily are no match for the enterprise that hires them. Employees gain strength, however, if they can deal with their employers in numbers. That's the very reason why labor law secures against employer interference employees' right to act in concert for their mutual aid or protection. End of quote. So Justice Ginsburg totally recognized and honored workers' rights to act collectively, and that was the heart of her dissent. It was the heart of her dissent in the Epic System case. And I think that it's really significant, because what I think we will see if we wind up with Judge Barrett on the U.S. Supreme Court, I think that there'll be no understanding of that reality, and so certainly no appreciation of that. And I think that we see that by the analysis and the outcome in the decision that she wrote in the Grubhub case, which, you know, I think, again, the facts were different. It was obviously a different analysis, but they really came out on opposite sides of this issue of worker rights.
It's just another institution that's going to come down on workers. You and I have talked about the National Labor Relations Board and how they stacked up against workers, and you're going to have the U.S. Supreme Court with the addition of Barrett, if that should happen. I want you to take a look back here, and it's interesting because Trump said, oh, we got to have a woman on the court because Ginsburg was a woman. If you go back almost 30 years, what was it? Thurgood Marshall passed away, and he was replaced by who? Clarence Thomas?
Absolutely. And I think that that's just such an interesting parallel. And I think that, you know, Justice Thurgood Marshall was the first African-American on the U.S. Supreme Court. He was appointed by President Johnson. He had been the NAACP general counsel. He had argued 32 cases before the court. And he was just a giant as a civil rights lawyer. And then he was replaced by Clarence Thomas, where really all they had in common was their race. And now we're looking at the same thing, where pretty much the only thing that Justice Ginsburg and Judge Barrett have in common is their gender. And I think that, you know, what it's as though all that matters is race or gender, and not what the individual's ideology or approach or sensitivities to other issues are. And, you know, what I'm afraid of is, like Clarence Thomas, it appears that the ones who opened the door for them to walk through, whether it was in this case, in his case, whether it was Thurgood Marshall, or in the case with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, it seems that their replacements will just shut the doors right behind them, because they just represent such a different ideological approach than the people that they are replacing on the court.
It's really sad, because the polling indicates the public does not want this to happen. They want to wait after the election. Poll after poll after poll. And Mitch McConnell, all he wants to do is ram this through. You got millions of people that are hurting out there. The stimulus talks, they're on again, they're off again. We don't know where they're going to go. But Trump made it clear the other day that, number one, he wants to get this done. He wants to get Barrett on the court. Very, very unfortunate. Joyce, I'm going to leave it on that note. Joyce Goldstein Law. Now, is that website already up, or what's the case right now?
Well, it's still Goldstein Gregel for the next few weeks. But as of the 1st of November, it'll be joycegoldsteinlaw.com.
Gotcha. And the phone number, 216-771-6633. Joyce, you take care, be safe, and we'll talk next month, okay?
Thanks, Flash. You too.
All right. That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up on Monday, Gina Walsh on the Tradeswomen Build Nations Conference, the latest from the Office of the Ohio Consumer Council, and how voting in America has turned into a nightmare. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful weekend.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.